Jim Kushner, Fellowship of St. James. About the incompetent Congress, I'm reminded C.S. Lewis in his private correspondence showed a disdain for politics and wondered if maybe there was a stagnation party, capital S, capital P, stagnation party. Sounds like a good idea. However, given all the legislation that's been passed the last number of decades, it seems that some reconstruction or repeal is needed. Certainly that's in the air. And also, is there some kind of a role that Congress itself should embrace in redefining, adopting some of the things you mentioned at the end that Reagan wanted, that would put in place a restrained, stripped down, and much more limited? Do we need to do something to define the limitations of government more than what's already in place? Obviously, that's not worked. So onto the stagnation party. That's just my question.
Well, I'll start out anyway. I've been toying with the idea that maybe the most effective way to shut down Washington, D.C. would be to strictly apply the Americans with Disabilities Act, because Washington, D.C. discriminates against dyslexics. If you think about how, though you know Washington, everything's done in an acronym. You know, George Will likes to say lately, you could take any three letters of the alphabet, throw them into a hat, and pull them out in random order, and you will discover a federal program that we can do without. The way Ronald Reagan would talk about it, I think, if he were around today. So, the formal idea would be some kind of, various ideas have been proposed, some kind of, I'm not sure Committee on Revision is right, but something to, you know, scrutinize old laws that should be got rid of. These things get tried now and then and never get very far, but I do think you need the general argument. One of the things I'm noodling with is, what would Ronald Reagan say today about the Constitution? And I think it would start off something like this. Our founders gave us a Constitution that had a gas pedal to make the country go and brakes to keep it under control. And what modern liberals have done is they've torn out the brake and pressed the pedal to the floor and are driving us over a cliff. And it's time to put the brakes back on. So I think that's the kind of language you would use. And I think you need to start with something like that and then go on to your specific. Reagan would then illustrate ways you're going over the cliff. You know, if you think of the great speech in 1964, $1 billion stacked, reaches the moon and back, or whatever those images were that he used that were so vivid. He'd use lots of things like that and then get into the. So I think that's the way you would go about it. And although, it's fine to try some committee of revision or to sunset old laws is fine, I generally think those gimmicks tend not to work in the real world.
Yeah, I'd add a couple of things to that. One, I think it is difficult to get Congress to do this on its own without some outside incentive, particularly because the election structure for individual members is such that no one's going to get voted out of office for their positions on questions like budget or constitutional structure, at least not over the long term. Presidents can make that an issue in such a way that maybe members of Congress would have to take it seriously. It's also the case that there are policies out there people could rally around in this respect. Tax law is probably the primary one. If you want to look at the issue of how laws have built up and you need to do something to change this, tax simplification is certainly it. I have never understood why Republicans have not managed to make more out of this issue, because it seems to me a classic one from a policy perspective but also from a constitutional perspective. Because laws that are too complex to understand are not laws anymore.
Question?
For Professor Nichols, your argument that Congress, in terms of its individual members, are kind of too narrow-minded or too small-minded to see the big picture and do any nationwide change in budget priorities, and therefore the rhetorical presidency is needed in that way, it reminded me of Woodrow Wilson's argument about Congress being so fragmented and so bound to special interests as to be unable to lead the nation in anything that needs to be done, and that I think was part and parcel of a more fundamental argument against the founders, that somehow Congress is misconceived or misdesigned because it's so tied to the local and now to the special interest, rewards and such. Do you see any similarity there, or do you have a more fundamental critique of Congress in mind?
I think the critique is Congress's attempt to take over roles that it was never designed to take, particularly in terms of executive functions and maybe even judicial in some cases. You could say Wilson's critique is true but wrongheaded in the sense that Wilson's problem with Congress is that Congress wouldn't use popular opinion to escape the Constitution. My criticism is that Congress will not use its popular base to support or defend the Constitution. And I think this is an example where the founders understood why. If you're elected every 2 years, you're going to be much less likely to take that kind of perspective. Unlike some folks, I think the founders created much more three co-equal branches rather than a notion of legislative supremacy. And I think they had a much more robust idea for how a president would play a part in the policymaking process than some people. It's become commonplace to assume that this role is new. And I do not believe that it is new. I think it's occurred throughout American history.
Could I just follow up?
Sure.
I mean, given what you just said about the House, do you then fault the Senate for, I guess you could say, not producing the Daniel Websters, the John Calhouns, the Henry Clays, you know, that could really take a national agenda?
Yes, and in part I fault the Senate because of a problem that is inherent in the Constitution, that most senators want to be president and few to become president. And I think that creates a certain level of frustration where senators often tend to denigrate the presidency precisely because they can't get it. And I think that tends to undermine separation of powers.
By the way, there's a good lesson there, I think, in rhetoric about all the would-be presidents in the Senate never understand why the Senate wrecks their chances to do it.
Yeah.
And partly, it's in my mind, it's rhetorical, because what do senators do? They give speeches. And so I used to tell students about this in the 2000, I was teaching during the 2004 election during the primaries. I said, you watch the Democratic debate. And I was trying to explain the reason why governors make better candidates, because they're executives who do things and are accountable and make decisions, whereas senators mostly just bloviate. I said, you watch what will happen. Howard Dean, and it almost unfolded this way, Howard Dean will stand up and say, I am the only person here who gave equal rights to gays and lesbians in my state. You know, as a guy, of course, didn't really, never mind that. But Richard Gephardt, you know, an honorable guy and more deserving guy among that field, in my opinion, in some ways, he'll stand up and say, and remember, he has a lesbian daughter, he'll stand up and say, I'm for equal rights for gays, too. That's why I have always supported a rider to the subappropriation for the soils conservation markup, right? So, you know, that's the way it falls out. And suddenly, you start talking that way on Capitol Hill. And a few months later, John Kerry says, I actually voted for the bill before I voted against it. And he hasn't the slightest clue why he's an idiot. Whereas a governor wouldn't talk that way. But that's what happens to those guys. And that's I think that's a real rhetorical aspect of the way politics works on the Hill.
You're over here. Yep.
If I believed what I read on the New York Times op-ed page, I think I would be forced to conclude that Obama's either a liar or a bigot. And so this question's directed to either of the two speakers. It was kind of, it came to me while Steve Hayward was speaking towards the end of his talk about the constitutional questions, and it got me thinking back to Professor Nichols' talk about the contrast between the Congress and the presidency as two branches of government, and I thought we had left out the judiciary. So my question here, and I'll explain the reference to being a liar or a bigot, it seems to me that what Obama has said in his rhetoric about marriage and gay rights issues is that he's for marriage as a union of a man and a woman. If he actually believes that, and I read the New York Times, then I would have to say he's a bigot, because we all know that's a bigoted view, according to the Times. I don't think he's been called out on this, because I think everyone knows he's really lying. But he has the luxury of passing the buck on this. I think everyone in the Congress and the president are just hoping that the courts take this issue out of their hands. So I was wondering, how does that, the third branch of the government, affect the rhetoric that we see from the executive?
Would you like liar or bigot?
I'll go with liar, but okay. It would be fun if somebody maybe in a 2012 campaign would ask Obama, so you think marriage should be reserved for man and woman? Please tell us why, and watch him sputter around about that. I mean, the best he could do is, it's my religious tradition, which would be fine, but that would displease a lot of his, anyway.
Yeah, I think the court's also a two-edged sword, and I guess this goes back to my point on the presidency. It's not that I don't think there are dangers of rhetorical presidency. I also think they're necessary virtues. and that you don't want to leave the rhetorical presidency to liberals. I would say the same thing is true of the court. One of the reasons the court became involved in many of these issues where I think they should not be involved is precisely because they lost the role that they played in terms of maintaining some notion of constitutional limited government. So they decided to imitate, because if the Constitution was meaningless, didn't give them any discretion, any role to play, then they had to come up with an extra constitutional one. And that's the criticism for both the presidency and the courts. But the solution is not to say, yeah, you're right, the Constitution's too narrow to leave you guys anything to do, because that just leaves you with Congress.
Over here.
Thank you. Greg Kaza with the Arkansas Policy Foundation. Thank you for your presentation. And I was wondering if both of you might elaborate on whether you see any contrast between the use of rhetoric by Bill Clinton and Barack Obama. Contrast Clinton with Obama, as opposed to contrasting Reagan with Obama.
I'd have to go back and read some of Clinton's speeches and lay them next to Obama and think about it for a while to give a good answer to that. My hunch is Clinton would come out better for this reason. He had been a governor of a southern state with a lot of conservative elements. He dealt with Republicans. He dealt with people who disagree with him. And as Jim Caesar was saying last night, he just had a better, I think this is runs in Southerners, he just had a better feel for politics. And so here and there in his rhetoric, I think you saw him make, remember running for president, he talks about we're going to end welfare as we know it, which of course he didn't really mean. He was kind of lying about that and then got cornered into it. Whereas Obama is much more stubbornly ideological and I think really has blinders on and has not been an executive, has never really had to deal with conservatives or to the extent he's had. Richard Epstein tells stories of having lunch with Obama and finding him an absolute brick wall. Utterly unable to get anything across to the guy at all. Just based on those superficial considerations, I think you could detect some differences in the rhetoric. I will say this: Obama's speechwriters are apparently all 20-something folks. Now Reagan had some 20-something speechwriters, but he also had adults at the top of the speechwriting food chain. And I actually think that if you really spent time going through this, you'd find that the lack of historical perspective of his speechwriters goes in perfectly with Obama's own defects of historical depth in ways that show up in his remarks.
Yeah, I would argue that in some ways Clinton had a good legislative rhetorical style in the sense that he was able to split differences. He was able to compromise. He is what a good congressman or senator would be at their best. Obama is a bad legislative rhetorician. He is simply going to be one who does overpromise, who does not see a need to compromise, and I think doesn't appreciate the fact that there are different concepts of power within the context of the Constitution.
Thank you.
Peter?
Given the problems already outlined with the rhetorical presidency and so forth, and given the real problem of permanent campaigns starting from Clinton, that is to say, saying that a campaign, the governing, there's no difference between campaigning and governing from Clinton's point of view, and given the third possibility, which is that the so-called Tea Party movement is an actual substantive ground-up movement that is really much more fundamental than even you and I might think, how should a Republican candidate or a constitutional candidate going, assuming the possibility of being nominated in 12, go about talking about the current political situation we find ourselves in?
I think beginning by taking them seriously and seeing what are the constitutional sentiments that you're seeing in the Tea Party movement. I have a good friend who studied the 1912 election, and he considers this one of the most important elections in American history, and he thinks that in some ways the Constitution actually managed to win, that the worst aspects of the progressive movement were in fact defeated in 1912. And I believe he thinks that what we have to do in this election is to also launch a similar kind of rhetorical attack to make questions about constitutionality legitimate questions again. And I think the Tea Party movement can be a vehicle for that. So it's not a simple populist movement, it's a populist movement rooted in a sense of American Republican principles.
That's Sid, I take it, you're talking about, 1912 book.
No, this is actually Bill Schammer.
Oh, Bill, okay, right. Yeah, the thing that, well, two things to say. One is that the Tea Party movement, liberals want to write off as, you know, just racist, reactionary, whatever. But Republicans are terrified of them, too, because they can't quite control them. That's probably, not probably, it is a good thing. But one of the things that, to me, is makes it so salient is, you know, you hear all this talk at the Tea Party rallies and Tea Party activists about the Constitution, wanting to get back to limited government. But these are not folks who have been to graduate school and have studied this in any detail. So, you know, we'll say, what about Article 1, Section 8 and the necessary proper clause? Does that mean anything? Or the Commerce Clause? What do those mean anymore? And they don't, but they know something's wrong, and they know that we're supposed to be limited by our Constitution in some way, which means the cliche you use these days, we have a teachable moment. I don't tend not to like that phrase. It's overused. What I do think you have, to borrow another problematic phrase, is that political scientists are starting to borrow from Stephen Jay Gould, is punctuated equilibrium. It's the idea of evolution, which may or may not be sound, I don't know, but you go along for a while, then something dramatic happens that disrupts the order of things and something new comes along. I think we're at one of those moments, or the third way of thinking about it is the Overton window. As Joe Overton said, there are times when a window opens when you can do something. Glenn Beck made it a novel, and now we're all confused again. But the point is, we're now at a unique moment that only happens periodically in American political life. 1912 was one of them. This may be another one where there's a moment when someone who talks in, I'll just say, constitutional accents can make a lot of progress down the field. And I've been meaning to sort of write, talk about how Reagan might give a speech. I've been meaning to write several sort of set-piece speeches on what you would say on the stump about this. That would have a general teaching and specifics geared to Obamacare or whatever it is, you know, seems like the right thing to go after. And, you know, it's on my to-do list, but it ought to be on everybody's to-do list.
Thank you.
Well, thanks very much indeed for your speeches. My name is Mike Breidenbach, and I'm a student at the University of Cambridge. The accent betrays otherwise. I have a question, and it was spurred by what Dr. Nichols said about Newt Gingrich trying to mold the American Constitution in a sort of a parliamentary style in which he would be prime minister and Clinton would be relegated to a ceremonial role. It spurred a comparison with the UK parliamentary system. And I was wondering if the concerns about the rhetorical style of the presidency was due more to the idea that the president is not only the leader of America, but also the leader of a party. In a similar way that the prime minister in the UK is more or less the leader of a country, but more so the leader of a partisan party that has a manifesto and that they have the ceremonial role as well. Is it the case that our problem with the rhetorical presidency is that it's also a divisive partisan head and it kind of has this bifocal sense of both leader of America and a partisan party?
I guess I'm tempted to say I don't think so, but one of the, maybe you'll experience this over in England. I know a lot of conservatives in England who said, I don't understand how you can have a president be your head of state. Because the head of state's supposed to be the unifying figure, the queen, right? And you know, most, and even the countries that are no longer constitutional monarchies, you have your president, and then you have your prime minister, and that's the partisan figure and the party government figure. But the president's supposed to be the, you know, where's De Gaulle in France, or you never know who these people are, right? Because they don't really count in real politics much. But there's nothing really. I mean, Franklin Roosevelt was a very partisan president. I mean, he'd make these very sharp attacks on Republicans as president in the re-election campaigns and, you know, throughout. So this is not really just a recent thing. But you know, I don't know. The different systems we have that allow shadings of meanings. I mean, you know, the facing benches you have in the British Parliament is, as Churchill explained it, is meant to point out that there's a sharp divide between the parties, whereas our semicircular assembly with people elected on different schedules from the president means that more shadings of opinion and more confusion of the picture is possible. So that doesn't help answer your question very well, but I think that the differences in the system say a lot about it, and then that whole business about can a partisan person be the head of state is an interesting question that we don't think about much in this country.
Professor Nichols?
Yeah, I actually think we did think about it at the time of the Constitutional Convention. And one comment that is often forgotten at the Constitutional Convention is that the man who wrote the Constitution, a guy named Gouverneur Morris, said political parties in a democracy are inevitable. And in our constitutional system, we are going to have political parties, and they're going to form over the question of the office of the presidency. Because one party will have the office, and another party will want it. And this is going to be the inevitable result of American politics. Not everybody understood that, but he did, and I think it is an essential aspect of democratic government.
I'm going to go to Lee Edwards, and then I'll come to you. Lee, what's next?
I do have a question, but first, as a for point of information, that has references to the Do-Nothing Congress. As a matter of history, the original Do-Nothing Congress was the 80th Republican Congress in 1947 and 48, which had an incredible record of success. They cut taxes, they reduced government spending, and they brought about the policy of containment. The Truman Doctrine supported that, Truman being the Democratic president at the time. The Marshall Plan and NATO. And what happened, of course, was that Harry Truman used rhetoric and demagogued against Congress as being do-nothing, when in fact it was one of the most successful and effective Republican and conservative Congresses in modern American history. My question, which is not so much mine, but I know one that Klaus Wren would ask if he were here. So it's in the spirit of Klaus Wren that I ask this. One of Reagan's favorite expressions, he loved to use the line over and over again, and I can see Steve smiling and nodding his head, you know what I'm going to say. Quoting Tom Paine, we have it in our power to make the world over again. So my question, Steve and David also, how conservative is that?
It used to drive Russell Kirk crazy. George Will zinged on that one more than once. He'd say, anytime, anywhere, that is nonsense. He said, Reagan is fond of quoting the most unconservative sentiment possible. Anytime, anywhere, that's nonsense. I'll just say this. That's an example of Reagan's idiosyncratic conservatism. It was not orthodox, you know, Russell Kirk style, or even libertarianism. I mean, I could go on a while about all that, but partly that expressed the part of him that was the optimist and understood that the American story was a story of change. And so he was never the simple reactionary that liberals made him out to be, but they never did perceive that very well. I'll just say that, and I don't know if you want to weigh in on that or not.
Yeah, just to say, you know, the problem of being a conservative in every respect is sometimes things need to change, and Reagan appreciated that, and without the possibility of things changing, we would have been left with a lot of things that we would want. Same true today.
Jim?
If I think of people in public office today, most effective rhetorician who stands head and shoulders above anybody else I can think of is Chris Christie. But he's made what I think is pretty close to a Sherman statement. And in any event, I think one thing maybe we ought to have learned is that 2 years in high office is not enough experience. So, Steve, I wonder if you would talk, though, about potential Republican candidates and if there are any that you think have potential to be very effective in the right sense, rhetorical presidents.
Good question.
Oh.
Put him on the spot. Good question.
Yeah, that's a great. As I say, being something of a skeptic of, my personal ideal favorite would be another Calvin Coolidge, who, as I was saying earlier, was not a great speaker in the ordinary sense, even though his rhetoric, formal rhetoric, was great. That said, I'll just give my opinion. My favorite guy right now is Mitch Daniels, who's not an exciting guy. He's actually a pretty funny guy. He's got some wit about him and could probably give a decent enough speech. Ordinarily, I think it was Andy Ferguson who wrote, what happens is he'll walk up to Obama, he'll come up to Obama's navel, and the election is over. I'm not sure that's true, because he's small, right? I'm not sure that's true. I actually go with the conventional theory that people tend to like the opposite of what's in front of them when they're unhappy with what's in front of them. So Obama was the not Bush in the biggest way possible, and that worked very well for him. And if we're in a circumstance where people are really concerned about out-of-control government spending and debt that's going to drive us over a cliff, and Daniel's going to come in with his record, and he looks like a nerdy accountant, I think he might match up real well with Obama. And the shortness in an odd way could be an asset for him. Now, maybe I'm being optimistic or all the rest of that. Some other people are very good, too, but he looks to me to be the strongest guy. I've talked with him. He says he doesn't want to run. I kind of believe him because who wants to do that? It's just, it is, you know, a daunting thing to contemplate. But he's getting his arm twisted awfully hard, and he's being clever to not say no, unlike Governor Christie. I like Governor Christie's reasons. His sort of first reason is, I'm too fat, which I also think would work for him, by the way, the way America is today. But also, I think there may be a sense he has that, right? Time to have another Robert Taft or William Howard Taft-sized president. I also have a suspicion about him that he thinks 2 years is too short to run and that he needs to finish his work in New Jersey. You know, that could be right, and it's an honorable thing. I sort of like that about him if that's right. On the other hand, you know, you strike when the iron is hot. That's what Obama did, got him there. So I think, hope Christie doesn't close the door to it. I think he's an amazingly compelling figure, and what makes his rhetoric so powerful in my mind is the obvious courage the man has. I mean, you know, when people get up and give him guff, he gets back in their face, and when he's done, it is all over. I mean, it's even better than I paid for this microphone, Mr. Breen. I mean, it is just every time. What's that?
It's always courteous.
Yes, that's right. Yeah, exactly.
For New Jersey. Professor Nichols, anything you want to offer?
No.
I want to appreciate the panel. I also appreciate the questions. We have a special time of appreciation for the great work Ed Fulner has done for our movement at the reception that begins at 6:30, and we look forward to that. Thank you very much.